Hello, I'm your host, Kathy Chester, and welcome to the Move It or Lose It podcast, a podcast about all things that move the mind, body, and soul. The Move It or Lose It podcast is for information, awareness, and inspirational purposes only. I am not a doctor, and I don't even play one on TV. So please consult with your doctor before making any medical decisions. The views expressed by advertisers, guests, or contributors are their opinions and not necessarily the views of the Move It or Lose It podcast. Hello, guys. This is Kathy Chester with Move It or Lose It. I'm so grateful to be back again another week. And today, you may know this lady. We've got Roxy Murray on today, and I'm very excited to have you on today. Thank you so much for being on my podcast, Roxy.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here and finally get to speak with you, which is something I've always wanted to do.
And I just happen to love your voice, and I know everybody else will as well. So you do so many things, and there's so much about you. And you're funny, and I know we're collaborating on a project that's top secret, but there's so many things that you've accomplished, so many things that you're in the middle of doing. So I want to talk about a million things with you, but we don't have time for that. So talk to our listeners a little bit about who you are that don't know you, and what was life like before MS and all the other fun things came into your world?
Okay, so obviously, as you know, my name is Roxy Murray. I am from London, UK, England. And obviously, I have MS. I was diagnosed in 2014, which I say officially, because I'd been dealing with MS from the age of 18, but I was misdiagnosed. But before MS, I was basically studying fashion for a few years. I went to fashion university. I was working as a fashion stylist for editorial magazines, also doing freelance work under other stylists and then helping out on fashion shows and styling for runway shows in London, which was really fun.
I can't even imagine.
It is like a whole other world. It's so creative. And that gives me so much joy, is being around creative processes and creative people, because it's how I express how I feel internally. Right. And I loved it. It was like the best thing ever. I would recommend art therapy or creative therapy to everybody.
How old were you at this time?
I've done art and design and fashion from the age of 13 to 21.
Wow. At 13, I didn't even know how to put lipstick on.
Well, see, neither did I, but I would draw, like I would fantasize. You'd look in magazines and you would see, I love movies, and I would look at other people in movies and be like, oh my God, they look incredible. Like, I want to look like that one day.
Wow.
You'd look at their clothes and you'd be like, I can't go to a shop and buy that. Like, how did that get created? Who created it? And it takes you on a rabbit hole of research. And I love research and especially fashion, because it's just, it's fantasy. Who doesn't love fantasy?
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. So you started doing this and you're really into it at this point. And so as you're going on, you're listening, you're doing the runway stuff, right? You had already, at that point, you had already started designing stuff and doing runway. And then you get diagnosed. So how hard was it to get the diagnosis? Was that really tricky for you?
It was during my university. So I wasn't necessarily, I don't design clothes. I style humans or people or set designs, like things that people put individuals in. It's like you behind you, you've got a beautiful setup design behind you. It's like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I was doing that at university because you work along studying. And then what happened was I just realized, like, I was going around picking up samples because you go to different PR agencies to select clothes for shoots and stuff. And I just couldn't go anymore. Like, it was like my body had decided absolutely not. And I didn't know why.
Fatigue would set in.
Yeah, but I didn't know why. Like,
but you had no idea.
It's like, you know, 12-hour days. You're like, well, maybe I'm just working. Or maybe you're young. You're like, I can do everything. So you know, maybe I drank too much last week, or I've done too much this week. And basically one day my body was just like, absolutely not. And I woke up in my mum's house, fully blind in one eye, double vision in the other. And I was like, what? Like, what's going on? No one else was in the house. So can you imagine, there's no one even to be like, hi, mum. I can't see. I was like, hold on, what did I, you know, you have to like, you go, what was I doing yesterday? Like, right. I don't remember drinking or like, you know, thinking, what's going on? Freaked out a little bit. I had to go to the hospital and they were like, oh, we think you might have a brain tumor.
Oh, God.
18. Yeah. And I was like, right? I don't know. Like, how would you do other than panic in that moment?
Terrifying. So at that point, no one was with you yet?
No. And they were like, we'll send you to the hospital, the local hospital, because obviously we'll have to either give you steroids or something to help try and bring your sight back, but we'll do other tests. Fine. Got there, saw like proper neurologists and stuff, and they were like, okay, so we're going to do some research and stuff. And they gave me steroids. Thankfully, steroids did bring my sight back.
Right.
Thankfully. And they basically were like doing other tests, blood tests and stuff. And they came up with that I had benign intracranial hypertension, which is your spinal fluid rising too quickly and then putting pressure on your brain, which would affect your optic nerves in the same kind of way of multiple sclerosis. They decided I had lupus because they did a test and there's like an antibody that picks up, but you can get false negatives and false positives.
Sure.
With lupus. That's the problem.
Now, if I understand you do have lupus though, correct?
No.
No, you don't.
No,
okay.
I don't. No.
Okay.
So I'll tell you that because basically, so they thought I had lupus and Fosterhoff syndrome. And I just can't have tension.
I feel like we're watching ER right now when they say it's lupus, it's this. And it's like, no, it's, I felt like I could quote it from there. No, it's never lupus. It's never MS. Keep going. It's always something crazy.
Well, it was basically like, it was years ago. And you know, with MS, like they didn't know that brown people had MS back then.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
No, it's lupus or it's sickle cells, whatever they consider brown people to have.
Right. It's always a sexual disease for sure. It's either a sexual disease. It's, all those things. It just makes me sick.
And my mom's white. It's crazy. She's sitting next to me and they're going, they're not even considering, well, you do have white genes. So even if you're just like a possibility of what could be, maybe we should broaden the spectrum. You have a black mom and a white mom. Maybe you can have something from either side of your genes. But no, it was like, literally, you're brown. That's it. You've got lupus.
Right.
And yes, they did find an antibody, but we realized it's a false positive because two years ago, I had like a massive like meltdown with MS. And I got really frustrated because my journey had been a bit up and down. And obviously, because they misdiagnosed me, I went for years without MS treatment, which is not optimal for anyone. And I'd lost a lot of functioning in my left side. And I still do. I have to use mobility aids and stuff. And I was like, look, I need to know, do I have MS? Absolutely. Do I still have lupus on top of MS? And do I have antiphospholipid syndrome as well? I know I have benign intracranial hypertension. That's not something I can get away from. Right. But thankfully, it kind of levels itself out depending on your stress levels and stuff. So
okay,
the better you treat yourself, the better it works for you.
Right.
And I forced the hand of neurologists and was like, look, I need to know because now you want me to take more drugs or different drugs. What am I treating here? Like, am I treating all these things, one thing? Because I've never had a good time with my MS drugs yet. Like, I've not found that drug that actually works for me, unfortunately. Uh-huh. And they did all the tests again, and they sent me to one of the top lupus and antiphospholipid people, and they were like, you absolutely do not have this.
Wow.
I don't know why, but obviously it's false positives. And I've had more than one test for that now, and every time it's come up negative. So I know it's just MS. But I had to fight for that.
Yeah.
Because that came from basically a few years later after getting my lupus diagnosis. I was at my partner's house and I was working like a part-time job because life had to get a little bit less stressful, even though I was still doing fashion on the side, but not in the same capacity.
Right.
And I couldn't put my hands above my head to stock some clothing on the shelf. And my manager, who knew I had lupus, was like, look, you're not okay. And I think you should go to the hospital locally. And that was like in Kent, which is not central London at all. And I was like, okay, a bit dubious. And then I saw this female neurologist and she was like, do you know that you look like you've had a stroke? And I was like, no.
Wow.
She's like, your face is slightly dropped.
Yeah.
And I'm reading your notes and I'm not seeing, like, my brain's not thinking what they're saying you have is what you have, because it wouldn't manifest like that.
Sure.
And she was like, do you mind? Because I was having therapeutic lumbar punches, and you know there's nothing therapeutic about a lumbar puncher. Like, horrendous, right? Every couple of weeks, every 6 weeks or so.
Oh my goodness, wow.
To drain the spinal fluid from benign cranial hypertension. Right. Because I had the MS on.
So bad for you. Yeah,
it was horrible. It's horrible. Oh. Now I'm strong for it, but at the point I just was having a mental breakdown on the stage. Right. And she was like, can I give you, because I kept going and refusing it. So like previously, I think about in the last 3 months before that, I was like, I'm not having any more lung punches. I can't cope emotionally, physically, and mentally having lung punches all the time. I hate needles.
Well, me too. The stress of that. I mean, I've only had three my whole life. And the stress just leading up to it is just, I can't imagine what you went through.
No, it's horrible. And they wouldn't sedate me until this time. So right. Other people know we can't sedate you, because obviously you need to be fully, so we can understand if you're paralyzed, because there's so many risks, as you already know yourself. And I was like, okay. She's like, please, can I just do one more lumbar puncture and I'll test your oligonal bands? No one had ever done that. No one had ever tested my fluid.
Seriously.
For the amount of fluid that had come out of my body every couple of weeks. No one thought, I'll send it off a test and see if it's this other thing. She did it, came back positive, was like, you have MS. And I was like, relieved. It sounds really weird, but I felt like at least I knew what I was dealing with. And it's one thing, and I could research it and try to understand it. Obviously, they give you that. There's no cure. So you kind of go, oh,
right.
I don't know. Is this, what is this? Is this,
right.
Like, what's the, how's this going to come out? How's this going to manifest? And I was still young as well. So I was just a bit like, oh,
yeah.
My friends were traveling the world. They were going to America. They're going to Australia. They were like doing really cool things. And I'm at home trying not to cry, considering do I even have a future?
Right. All. Yeah. Yeah. A very scary time, right? That diagnosis is like, you don't understand it. It kind of freezes you. And you're like, we all go a different way. You know, we all accept it or not accept it, in denial, grieving in a different way. Like, what does this mean for my life? And when you're young, you know, we all get either a young diagnosis or older. Like I told you that I run a support group for women, and I wanted it to be just women so that we could share, you know, all that stuff, all the things that we want to talk about, whether it's sexual, whether it's, you know, just having a time where we just, you know, cry about crap that we didn't get to do, or just laugh and stuff. And I wanted it to be a safe place where women could just talk about stuff. And it is, it's like that grieving time, and it's not just one and done, you know, it's like, I feel like we come to different parts of our life where we lose something again. It's like we have to grieve it and then move forward. And in order to move forward, I think if you agree with that it's, you got to grieve it and not sit in that for too long, or it gets to that depression, but grieve it and then move forward with what you can do now. And I think that's a big part.
I mean, I absolutely got into depression because no one told me you need to grieve a diagnosis. They were like, here's a diagnosis, here's MS.
Go away.
My original neurologist took forever to even agree that I had MS. So I had to fight that fight. And that's like a whole thing. But when I finally got the MS diagnosis, I kind of realized that my whole world had changed. And I couldn't have to drop out of university. Like, there were so many things that happened, because back then, disabled people and people with disabilities and illnesses didn't have the same rights or the same understanding and the same support that we do now, thankfully. I would never wish what I went through on other people, but it was stressful, and no one around me knew what MS was. So that's one thing. So no one knew really how to support me, because we're all on the same journey trying to figure it out. And I was going through depression, but I was also in denial of the depression because I never knew I had to grieve or like the old life to accept the new life that I was having. And it took me 2 years without going outside. I couldn't go outside. I just didn't want to do or be or exist for a very long time.
Oh, Roxy, that makes me so sad.
Yeah, my partner, thankfully, loved them to bits. She basically was like, look, like you can't, like, you're too awesome to be like this depressed, and we're going to figure this out.
Has she been with you from the time of diagnosis or no?
Well, my real diagnosis, my official MS diagnosis, yes. My lupus diagnosis, no.
Okay.
So they were with me. They were in the hospital with me when I was told that I had MS and stuff. And they've been amazing. Like, at points where I've been an actual nightmare, because you probably know of MS, emotional problems, like,
oh, yeah,
things, just grieving, stressing. And I'm also an Aries, so I'm fiery anyway. So it's like all these combinations. I think I would have run away ages ago. I don't think I would have been able to cope with myself. So having someone that was like, look, I love you, I'm here for you, right, and no matter what, we're here together. There's not enough money in the world to give that person what they really deserve for what they put up with, yeah, me, and still do to this day. Right. And they drugged me out of it, but they are half American, and yeah, they came with what I will call the American way, which is that kind of self-help, look at it, learn to manifest, yeah, give yourself time, breathing, yoga. Yogic, yeah, kind of sensibility. And I was not like that. I like practical and over analytical, and it was very black or white. There was no gray. And they, right, and you know, they showed me color.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it, because now I'm here talking to you.
I love that. Because dating a British man years ago, it was all black and white. And I was like, whoa, like, there's some room for gray. And he was like, nope. And I was like, oh, okay. So it is funny. I did bring out some fun, and it was interesting, because that was the first British man I've ever dated. It didn't last. I married a wonderful man who, again, accepted the MS and my three children, and just, you know, really has been there. He did, like, I always joke that he was pushed into a quick version of learning about MS. And when he met me, you know, we've been married now for 4 years, but when we started dating, I was like giving him all this stuff. You have to be sure you want in on this, because I look really strong now, but this can take, it can take all sorts of, you know, turns, and I could be anywhere. So I really want you to understand what this disease is. So I think that having people supporting you, it sounds like you have a great support team, which is awesome. Are you battling a chronic illness like multiple sclerosis and know it's time to add exercise program and movement to your body in order for you to have the best health and independence for you? I am so excited to announce the launch of my new program, Damn It, a disrupt, move, and transform program for us autoimmune warriors with a trainer who really gets it, me. You can participate in either virtual one-on-one training, virtual group training, or both. To find out more on how you or loved one can benefit from this training, email me, msdisrupted@gmail.com. Message me on Facebook or Instagram at msdisrupted. Look at the website, msdisrupted.com. Take a look. Can't wait to see your face. So you had shared that it got to a point where you were so fatigued that you weren't able to do the things that you had been doing before diagnosis and even when you were diagnosed. So talk to our listeners about the shift and how you were starting to do fashion and things like that for disabled.
Basically, like I said, my partner had helped me just reevaluate life. Like, because I was so fatigued and stuff, I was like, my brain was like, absolutely, I just can't. That's all I thought. Everything was a no. And I had to find that yes in my life. And when they helped me find the yes in my life, I'd realized and analyzed what I'd gone through and realized there were so many unjust moments where my journey could have been easier and could have been way more positive if people, A, listened to what I was saying, didn't preconcept what they thought due to race, sexuality, gender, all that stuff, and just heard the full story. And I was like, look, I need to talk about this. And that's how I started the podcast, where I was like, look, I have to look at who I am. I'm black mixed race. I am a younger person. I love fashion. I'm so queer and I'm super creative. So I went with Sick and Sickening, and people go, why Sick and Sickening? I come from a very trans, queer, drag queen perspective. I'm sick. I have an illness, but I'm always going to be sickening. I love fashion. I love clothes. I love my queer culture. So that's where it came from. And I start to use that platform to basically just talk about my story first, because it was my therapy, you know, to open up, say how I felt, and hopefully help other people.
Was it scary when you first started that? Were you feeling like, I don't know how people are going to accept this?
Yeah, but also I will be honest, like I got to the point where I was like, look, like it was do or die at the point. I didn't know if I was going to survive, and I was so depressed that I wasn't going to continue.
Yeah.
I was like, can anything be any more scary than what I dealt with? So it was fearful in the sense of you going, what if people just hate it? They're like, get off my screen. But at the same time, I just felt, look, I'm going to do it. It could bomb. It could be great. But at least, like, you know, when people say journal.
Yeah.
I cannot write very well with MS. It's me not neither. My style anymore. So our voices are. And I thought, well, if anything, I've got a vocal diary of how I feel with MS and what I've been through. Because I know from interview to interview, the way my brain's working for MS, I've listened to interview and gone, why have you said that? That's not correct. Like, why has your MS brain pulled that word forward or said that date? Because it's not that date, it's that day. So it's nice to see kind of in a visual form, but in a vocal form where I'm at too.
Yeah.
And in that, I thought, I'm always going to look good, because MS takes that away from me a lot. And that really made me sad, because I always look like, have my fashion moment. And I was like, I'm going to combine all this, and I'm going to take it not just to people that have MS, but to people that have disabilities in general. Like, absolutely. We all want to be fashionable.
Right. I love the pictures that are on your Instagram where they're sexy and they're just showing that just because we're disabled doesn't mean we don't have sexuality and we don't want to look. And I say that a lot when I'm training, that it's okay that we do some things, not just MS movements or not just things to strengthen us, but what do you want to work on? What are some things that you want to do that make you feel sexy? Let's do some of that too, because just because you're diagnosed with this doesn't make, I don't want you to feel that you have less sexuality because of this. So I think that that's really important what you're doing, and that we don't feel less than because we've got whatever it is that we have. And that really hurts me so much when I see that I don't feel like I can have sex anymore because I just don't feel good about myself. And so I love what you're doing, because it's so important, because those voices have to be out and loud, because the idea that it's been shoved on the back, and we've seen it for so many years, that our disabled people don't get the care, and we're shoved aside. And I know that you deal, but, you know, just getting new canes, new AFOs, as, you know, walking sometimes is difficult, or the draw foot, it's like, I'll look the other way. I don't want to see you. And it's very frustrating. And I'm so proud of you for starting this and being brave enough to look and say, this needs to be done. This has to happen. And I'm not going to look the other way. I have a gift to do this, and I'm going to go for it. So when you started it, what do you see? What are you the most proud of?
For me, it's being able to just keep my personality and help other people keep their essence on their journey with MS or any illness. I'm lucky in the UK, we have a very amazing disability community, and together we all try to empower each other through fashion, and especially with our mobility aids, because they can be boring and bland and sad, and ultimately, we don't want that, because we're going to use them every day, all the time. And it's about your mental health and how you view yourself. And with a forever changing body, that changes day to day, I want to adorn it in the best way that I can. And for me, it was a massive shift of how I keep that fashion essence and my voice and my internal power while dealing with MS. And I'm proud that I've managed to do that for myself, but I'm also proud that I've managed to help other people on that journey. Just embrace even one thing. And I have people come to me all the time and they're like, well, like, what do you wear? And like, where did you get that mobility aid from? And like, how do you deal with accepting a mobility aid in your life and being okay with it. So having people like Neo Walksticks from Lindy creating amazing canes and stuff in any color you could ever imagine, people getting married with them, and they're feeling less isolated and less embarrassed about having to use something like that in their life, especially at a younger age, and being able to empower people to be like, I can literally be in an underwear set, be the sexiest person you've ever seen, and hold my mobility aid at the same time. And yes, it might confuse some people, but for other people, I'm like, look, we don't have to feel less than.
Yes.
Because we have that, or we have this illness. If anything, we can be more than. Who has a light up cane? Not very many people.
Exactly.
I think a disability can take away from you, but also you can flip on its head and make it gain confidence for you, where you go, you know what?
Absolutely. That's why I think I went with disrupt, because I love the idea of disrupting the idea that we are not taken away by the diseases or whatever has happened to us. We can disrupt and reframe that idea. And it's up to us to do that. And I think having that core group of people that help us, I think, is such a big deal, because it helps us to disrupt the idea that we are less than, or that we can't do something. It's just changing that. We already kind of touched on it, but what are those most exciting things that you've been able to help or design or get doing with a disabled that you've been able to look at and say, wow, that was one of my best moments?
For me, it's the conversations, the talks, the panels that I get to be part of. Like, I have some amazing friends in the fashion industry that are disrupting the fashion industry with making adaptable fashion. And I am grateful for them. And I'm grateful for being allowed to be on their journeys, because I'm not a designer, I'm a stylist. But being allowed to touch those clothes and also show right. people how to wear them in a way that may translate from style to style, because obviously we all have our own different styles, but there's certain pieces in fashion that you can use no matter what style you have by changing the accessories and the accoutrements and the things that you place with them. But being able to go on panels and talking about basically what the fashion industry means for disabled people overall, and seeing how disabled people actually interact with that and how they feel about people caring about them and their style. People think it's like, so that people overlook it all the time. They go, oh, why do you care? Like, are you alive? You got clothes? Da, da, da. But we don't. We don't have those things that help people with like stoma bags or with like catheters, the things that we do all deal with, or a lot of people deal with, but still want to be fashionable and still right. want to look cute, and being able to understand and try and help change the industry yes. in a way that makes clothing for us. Right. But for all people.
You mean we don't want to wear muumuus?
No, we don't want to wear muumuus. And at least yeah. make it a good muumuu, not just like a black or white muumuu. Like yeah. give us some colour, like open up the rainbow. I want couture clothing. I'm literally trying to short week. We'll put some disabled people in the runway and make avant-garde Met Gala ready outfits for them. Because there's no excuse anymore. Like, the wheelchairs could be chariots. Like, people spend so much money on their cars and they're on their selves and their bodies, but these are part of us.
Absolutely.
So why can't we have these things that make us feel like gods and goddesses and royalty overall? Right. We can feel like that. And if I can be a part of that, and I have loads of conversations and talks coming up where we're going to talk about like how the fashion industry can support disabled people more. But actually, if you look at fashion, not just as disability fashion, but adaptable fashion.
Yes.
Everyone can wear adaptable fashion.
Yes.
It works for everybody. And disability and the need for adaptable fashion is something that most people would deal with, because yes. everyone ages.
Yeah,
and, you know, 100%. Eventually, you don't want to bend over to tie your shoes up. You want something like Nike did, where you can just step in and just trainers are on. They didn't advertise that as disabled wear. They yeah. advertise it as adaptable wear.
Yeah.
And you can still do that, but don't forget to put us in the campaigns. And don't forget to show us as an option, as a customer, because we are a billion-pound industry.
Yeah.
And we do feel empowered by seeing ourselves and being able to share our sexuality.
Yeah.
So my proudest moment is being someone that has a big mouth, that will walk into any room and be like, this is not good enough and right. we're going to change it. And being able to do that recently in a Vogue article alongside another amazing MS person, which was Crystal, in relation to Christina Applegate was a beautiful moment, because obviously being a fashion student, you dream of being in Vogue. Could never get MS though. Like, who would have thought that years ago, oh, you're gonna have an illness and that's gonna get you in Vogue, not your fashion stuff. But it felt good to have that moment, so that when someone was turning that page, scrolling through the screen and stuff like that, they could see, oh, MS, and in a fashion magazine. And then literally weeks later, to see the actual disability issues that came out with Selma Blair and one of my friends, Fats Timbo, and all these iconic disabled people, to see that actually fashion finally is considering us. Yes. Seeing friends like Victoria Jenkins from Unhidden, who's put all that work in and one of the first people to be recognised in these magazines, is just, I don't know, it warms my heart so much.
Oh, yes.
We only have taken the first few moments, so there's so much more to come.
And it's so exciting to me.
Yeah, so exciting and so heartwarming, and it's going to be a beautiful adventure, I feel.
Oh, I agree. I think there's so much, and I really believe that when COVID happened, it got so many of us able to share, to come together, that our voices became so loud. And so, like, we're not taking this anymore. We're moving forward and there's no turning back. And it got us so much together in different countries. You know, because of that, we got close to so many each other that it was like, no, this isn't going to work anymore. We're not taking a back seat. Our voices will be heard, and we are enough and we are strong. And I know Stronger Together got overdone, and it's like, yes, we're stronger together. And it is a great, and it is very truthful. But when we come together and our voices are loud and we say, and, you know, not a terrible, you know, grouchy way where they look at us like, but we let them know that, yes, this is the truth and this is happening. This is what should have happened a long time ago. And our voices are coming together and saying, this is needed and this will happen. I think it's been so powerful. And, you know, having MS, I've over 20 years, it is so overdue. And it's so exciting for us to be able to watch and to have so many of us, and to watch what you're doing is so exciting. And I'm just so overwhelmed by watching you and so excited to see you do all this. It's just been very exciting to watch you. You're very vocal and influential regarding topics such as sexuality, advocacy, and the LGBTQ. I always get these wrong. My son's like, Mom, learn them. I'm like, I'm trying, but my memory.
It's a hard word with MS, though. It's like so many letters. I even go.
I know. I'm like, you know, the L. Da, da, da. And he's like, Mom. I'm like, Silas, I'm trying so hard. So something that is not often talked about. I mean, in my podcast, that was the one big thing, is that I want that completely open. And so I was so excited that you are so freely, able to talk about that. And I love that you do that in the podcast. So talk to me about when you decided to come out with that and discuss that. I see so many similarities in you not holding back.
For me, it was just a no-brainer. I'm an intersectional human being. I'm queer, disabled, and I will say iconic. Why not? And I was like, this is my reality and this is my podcast. Why am I not talking about my own reality? I have friends and other people that feel the same way. And a lot of podcasts are heteronormative. They stick to a certain kind of lane. And I listen to them and I think, that's not me. I don't relate to this. Not that, you know, I'm not against heterosexual people. Come on. But it's the fact that, like, if it doesn't relate to you, it's hard to sit there and listen, because sometimes I find them kind of toxic, as I'd be anti what I am or what my existence is. And I was like, there has to be a space where people are disabled, but also sexual beings, and also embrace their queerness. I have people from every background, every gender, and every sexuality that I talk to on my podcast. And we talk about things that really matter and really feel connected to who we are. And I've never shied away from it. And to be honest, like, I think, like, someone like Dawn has been very catalyst in that, because I started speaking on their podcast. That was one of the first podcasts I ever spoke to. And it's always very open and very unapologetic. And we speak about sex and polyamory and all these things. And I love that. I love those conversations, and I want to continue that in my own narrative because I think they're important. And disabled people's sexuality is never discussed, especially when you go to a hospital. And with MS, we deal with that. We have hypersensitivity, lack of sensitivity. Right. We don't know what's going on, and no one ever talks to you about it because they're like, are you alive? Are you on a drug? Great. See you later. See you in another 6 months to a year.
Yes.
What you were like, you were talking about, we've got partners and we have sexual needs. Like, it's not going to change with age or anything like that. I want to be 80 and disgraceful personally. And I want to feel that pleasure till my very last moment. And without talking about it, and I'll go and speak to the NHS and I will push them to ask them to change things internally, because it's hard to have those conversations and it's hard to remember everything you want to have in a conversation with a health professional. But I do think the health professional also should be asking disabled people, how is your sex life? Not just are you alive, because there's being alive and there's living, and I think sexual pleasure is part of living.
Yes.
And I think we deserve it, so I will always talk about it, because it's like a self-serving thing as well. I want to know, how's the best way to get an orgasm when you've got MS and you can't feel anything? I will go through that journey, find the answer, and then talk about it with everyone else. And also let everyone know the space for them to speak their truth. You don't have to hide.
I think it's so important. I think I agree 100%. It's not talked about enough. And it is something that we shy away from. And that was in the beginning of my podcast. I wanted that to be very open. And I think that that's so important, because it is. It's something it's part of us. And that whole sexual need is something that we don't want to give up. And so many women and men, I hear all the time, just, it's not a part of their life anymore. Is that what you want? No, but it just becomes on the way back burner. And so I think talking about it more and more is so important. So I love that you do that. I love that you're very open about that. And I think it gives an opportunity for so many people that are not just dealing with autoimmune diseases, but other things, and are still not knowing how to come out. And, you know, I know that with my son, it was, you know, we have a very good relationship, and he had, you know, talked to me through high school, and I have these feelings, I'm not sure. So we could go through that together, but that doesn't happen most often. And it's nerve-wracking and it's scary to come out. And so I love that you do that, that that's an open place for so many to come to listen to and to watch, and to have somebody so beautiful and bold like you to come out and talk about that.
Thank you. Like you said, sometimes, you know, parents or your family situation is not going to be great. And there's so many people that don't even have families, but it's nice to conversate and talk openly so that people feel like we can be your community, we can be your family, we can step in where people have stepped out so that you don't feel alone, because it can be lonely. Illnesses can be lonely, being queer can be lonely, and having all of the things together can be the loneliest. So just being able to show people that it's okay, and like, we're over here, and even though we might not even be in the same country, we can feel connected through conversation, is for me a very beautiful thing that we have.
I feel like I'm mom to all. I'm like, if you're not accepted, come on in. I'll make you dinner and love on you. Because it's such a big thing, you know, that I feel like we all need. So last question I have is, I want you to talk to me about it. What message would you leave with listeners? If you could say one thing.
That you're worthy, that you deserve space, that you should always take up the space, that the universe is yours, and that you should never feel ashamed for the person that you are. You are beautiful and you deserve everything. You deserve the world, and the world can be absolutely yours. Just embrace yourself and the rest of the world will start embracing you for your beauty.
I love that. Absolutely love it. It's beautiful. Roxy, where can people find you when they want to get a hold of you?
You can find me on Instagram at the Multiple Sclerosis Fashionista, or Multiple Sclerosis Fashionista, the Sick and Sickening podcast.
I love that. What a great title. Love that.
And on YouTube at the Multiple Sclerosis Fashionista also.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Move It or Lose It podcast, where you can again find us wherever you like your podcast, whether it's Apple, Spotify, join us on that. And we can't wait to see you again. We're going to have a lot of exciting guests and working together And as always, you'll hear us say at the end of every podcast, we are stronger together. So let's do it. Let's become stronger together. Have a great day. Hey.